and welcome to The Smoke Break. I'm your host, your old pal Zane, here with Zoe Schwartz.
Hello.
Taylor Barrett.
What up?
And comedian and
sociologist,
Olivia Zivit.
It's so good to be
here. We're going
to
do that again. I am so fucking sorry.
It was fun.
We got there
in
the end. You got the first half.
It's the friends we made along the way.
It's the friends we made along the way.
Yeah, that's a teamwork.
We made it.
Zane's like, we're done. We're out of here.
Time to go home.
It's a new one for me, too. I only recently got my degree. So
yeah.
I've been a comic for a while, only recently officially a sociologist.
All right. Well, you came here to talk a little bit about your research, so share a little bit with me what that's about.
Well, I got the opportunity to do some original research in the realm of what we call porn studies, which is not really a degree you get. It's more like a field of research you enter.
This is awesome.
Right. That's where
I'm
you
like,
start.
I think I have a degree in
you
that.
Know, it starts with that. It definitely starts with that.
Sorry.
There are no accidents. In this. No one's forced under duress to do this kind of research.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we have to be humble and, you know, honest about that. But basically, my degree is in historical sociology, which is the study of social change.
Okay.
And that's how I kind of, you know, would simplify it. But my research is about millennial women and millennial women's perspective on pornography throughout our lives. And obviously, I picked that demographic because I'm a millennial woman.
Sure.
And the reason I picked that is because I feel like we have this unique kind of like perspective of coming of age alongside the internet and internet porn coming of age. Like we remember like the before times. We remember like when porn was either on like the TV channel or like someone had the VHS or someone
the
had
VHS.
Someone had a magazine literally like you know, or
and a friend like rips out a page and you're like, this is going to my pocket. Hopefully
and
my mom
especially
doesn't
if
find
you
it.
Had older friends or older siblings, like you know, we remember accessing pornography and sexual media before the internet, and then we kind of became adults before smart technology really entered everyone's life.
Mm-hmm.
So most millennials like didn't have a smartphone till like after high school.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so like the way we accessed porn and the presence of porn in our lives was just really different from like Gen Z and anyone younger. Generation Alpha is up next. Good luck to them.
Good luck, yeah.
But yeah, so I just wanted to do these kind of like what we call an oral history based research where I interviewed women who are in this demographic and basically asked them questions like, what's your earliest memory of seeing porn? And what was your family environment like as far as attitudes towards sexuality?
Sure.
What was your school education like? And basically found, you know, my research was based on like a really incredible group of other researchers. As a master's level student, you know, you build your research based on previous findings to kind of like replicate and show and
like revalidate
right,
it.
Yeah. It basically like reinforce existing findings.
Sure.
Because research, you have to take like these tiny bites that are manageable bites.
She interviewed me too.
Really?
And she has a pseudonym in my study, so you'll never know who she is.
What's my pseudonym? Do you remember?
I wouldn't want to. I can't blow it. Like,
this was just a trick.
Oh, yeah, I'm a professional.
Yeah.
I'm a professional.
Hey, can you out one of your clients right now?
Absolutely not.
I'm sorry. You think I would understand how confidentiality
I have too
works?
Much respect for you.
Didn't you sign the HIPAA agreement?
Yeah.
No, you know, it's not medicine. So there was just it was what we call informed consent sheet. So, but interestingly, like my research showed a lot of women used porn or porn was like instrumental in the kind of discovery of their own sexual identity.
Yeah. Understanding the things that they like kind of by watching doing research about other people's research.
Exactly that. And like, you know, talking about people's
study up.
I mean, Malcolm Gladwell said you have to do something for 10,000 hours to become an expert. I'm a triple expert at porn.
I'm a triple expert.
I'm the best at porn. Right?
I mean, I'd say, I don't know how I could, I stopped counting after 30,000. Well, for research, for science.
Well, of course.
For science. No, actually, you know, my relationship with porn is one where it's like kind of professional, so I read a lot of porn instead of watching it. Because,
well, I mean,
like,
it sounds like you're trying to get an understanding of it, because it's like some people just kind of like watch it on the surface level of like, these are two people doing the thing I want to do. I'm going to imagine myself there. Oh, why is this still playing? Turn it off.
Well, the most interesting thing is that like porn represents like cultural norms.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, people don't don't necessarily have the opportunity to speak about how porn influences our, you know, expectations of ourselves and partners and sex itself and what sex should be and what pleasure should be, what pleasure should look like.
Yeah, we were just talking about how it's like a lot of people's main form of sex education is porn, right?
Exactly. And so people learn like what they think sex should be.
Yeah.
And if you're not careful, you can kind of end up losing touch with what you really want versus what you think you should be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we're totally influenced by culture as far as like what we find attractive. Like
this is what I'm supposed to do, right? This is what I'm supposed to like. Yeah. This is what I'm supposed
to. Even like the types of people we're attracted to is like socially.
This is
influenced.
What good sex looks like. Yeah. And, you know, especially.
This is how long you're supposed to last. Yeah. Like,
the idea of performing and not like receiving and giving pleasure.
Yeah, it's like
two different. It's two different things, right?
And porn is definitely a performance.
Yeah,
a lot of the time,
and you know, I feel like I don't want to say I'm worried about younger people because that's always been the case. Every generation feels worried about it because people adapt.
But the internet is a little scary.
But it is a little bit scary to think to think about people who are so young.
Oh yeah, I told one of my friends, I was like, your son's first introduction to sex is going to be porn, so you should probably consider like giving him some
talking
real information
about it.
He was like, I never thought about that. I was like, I'm over here thinking about your kids, okay? Like, that's the kind of shit I think about.
But it's so weird because maybe as a parent, you don't want to think about
it. Yeah, I'm sure he didn't. I'm sure he was like, Zoe, why are you harshing my mellow? I was like, because I want your kid to have extra information.
Well, and I feel like that's where like a lot of like the taboo and the stigma is like, we don't want to think about it. We don't want to, you know, like,
we don't want to talk about it.
We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to think about it. And therefore, like, people are getting into like things that, you know, they may not necessarily be healthy.
Understand.
Or understand. Right. Absolutely.
Or feel like their sex life is miserable or like repressed because they don't understand that they don't need to have this certain type of sex that like they might have, you know, like they're not getting to understand themselves sexually because they feel like something's weird about them because they don't fit that standard. Right?
I think that the problem is when there's stuff that's so hardcore online that is representing a fetish and like fetish porn doesn't often like feature consent and like conversations about safety.
Yeah.
So the fear is that like people will end up hurting others or being hurt, you know, in their youth. I'm talking like teenagers who are experimenting. And I feel like as millennials, we kind of like dodged a little bullet as far as like the degree to which we were exposed to that. But at the same time, you know, we had viral crazy porn, like Two Girls, One Cup.
Yeah,
we I've never seen that.
You've
I've never
seen good. It?
I had opportunities to, but I was just like, I don't need that.
So you know, it's not real poop.
So your soul
it's
is unshattered.
Poop.
Yes, it is.
You think it is?
Are you kidding me?
I mean, it's been like 20 years since
we finally cracked the code.
It's been like 20 years since I've seen it, but it was real poop.
What do you mean? How could they fake that?
I don't know.
They faked the moon landing.
It was at least
shit is nothing.
It was at least real vomit. At the very least.
Oh my God, that's really funny.
That's horrible. I think that what the research that I did shows is that we need to talk about these things.
And absolutely.
That was like part of what we bonded over when I first met her. I was like, somehow we were like, oh, you're Jewish. Oh, you're a Cancer. Oh, you're Canadian.
Yeah.
Because we're both all three of those things.
On and on and on.
And then she started talking about her research, and I was like, oh, I think this shit is fascinating. I totally want to talk. And then we were like,
Where do I sign up?
Yeah, I was like, I want to be friends with this chick.
Because everybody wants to talk about it, but like opportunities to do so are limited. And since, I mean, I've kind of been in this industry for like several years now. I started off by working in the adult toy industry. I worked at Liberator, and they make like sex furniture and like cushions and
furniture?
Stuff.
I want some.
Yeah,
furniture.
Like they make chaise lounges, and also like their famous product is called the Wedge, and it's like a foam wedge with like a washable cover that supports your body during sex and won't flatten like a pillow. So like it, you know, helps with like angles of penetration and stuff. They have patents on it.
I've seen pictures of it.
And they manufacture in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
Support American manufacturing.
Well, that's good. I'm curious because you guys are, well, I guess you're a little bit younger than her, but I'm curious just because you like what your guys's like experience with porn when you were younger, because you're a little younger than me. Like, was it the first like exposure you had to sex? Like, what was that like?
I think I discovered it a little bit before they covered it in like the health classes. Mm-hmm. And so when
they did cover it in health classes,
they didn't cover porn. Yeah, I discovered sex through porn
before any sex ed.
Before any sex ed. And so I remember being like, I know this shit. You know what I mean? But also like the difference in the approach obviously was extreme, because
the end goal. Yeah.
Yeah. because they talk about it so like medically almost in health. Yeah.
One day when you want to procreate and please God.
Yeah. And then this goes here and then this goes here and then you feel bad afterwards and then you don't talk about it and you deal with it.
Yeah. Maybe you have a baby.
And you're insanely horny. And you know, as going through puberty is just, it's insanity, the horniness.
Yeah.
It's insanity.
Yeah.
And no one talks about it. Yeah, everyone's just like, shut up, swallow it, like just fucking bury it.
Yeah.
What about you, Zane?
I would say like my first introduction was probably like a friend being like, here's a picture of something. And I'm like, that's not what I thought that looked like.
Yeah.
Like I thought a vagina was like an Audi belly button. Like, you know those things that you like...
like a little, like, what?
Like a pouch like or something.
Oh, you thought it was like a
basically
hernia.
Like a bigger penis,
like a
I guess.
Sleeve. It was like a sleeve.
Listen, I didn't have all the facts.
A fleshlight, like a human fleshlight.
I hate those words, that order, this conversation.
Sorry. No, but that's funny, though, but you didn't even know.
It was a friend, though, right?
Yeah. A friend of a friend was kind of just like, oh, this is
you want to see some shit?
Yeah, basically.
I feel like millennials did that a lot of watching porn in groups. And
I can feel less weird about the time that I did.
No. It's not weird. It's really common experience, I think, because like there was that middle ground of access where technology was kind of coming
and Girls Gone Wild. Remember that shit?
And just
Just coming on the TV.
Like, what about HBO late night? Like real sex on HBO.
Oh, I watched that a lot.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And I learned about a bunch of weird shit too because they did all the weird like kink, like people that were into like pony play.
Yeah.
But
that wasn't something
I thought, like,
that everybody
my first
had.
Trans person like have sex. Oh, yeah. I was like, wow, I actually think I was educated. And because it was like they didn't just talk about dominant culture shit. So I think it was probably a good part of my just being like, oh yeah, there's shit that
it was made to be kind of like a documentary for adults. But if you access that while you were also learning sex education, that kind of like coupled with that.
Yeah,
and
it would make we were so curious.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So desperate for anyone talking like straight about it.
Well, I mean, and who was Sue Johansson? Was that the talk sex person?
Oh, yeah. Sex with Sue?
Yeah. I
listened to Love Line with Dr. Drew a lot, too.
Oh, I remember that.
I was in, like, middle school just, like, staying up until, like, 2 o'clock in the morning listening to fucking Love Line, and I was like, these people are fucking nuts.
And then we got Dan Savage, and that really blew our minds, right?
I mean, all credit to Dan for everything in my life that's good.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think, like, just being able to, you know, like... Had I known what I was looking for, you know, like I feel like, you know, like there wasn't enough of like a like somewhere between like the super medical and the like the super entertainment. Like there wasn't like
fantasy,
there's pleasure and fantasy and all of these
conversation.
Things
and like how
conversation
and how you should approach it as
about,
an individual.
Yeah, and the connection between romance and sex.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like talk about as far as the 90s, early 2000s go, like all of these very toxic romantic comedy narratives about, you know, the role that men play and the role that women play and, you know, the beginning of like Sex in the City and stuff. And it was just, I don't know, I have this one very strong memory of being in high school and a friend, I was like middle school, maybe eighth grade, and a friend of mine who had a laptop and who had an older sister showed me a video that her sister had sent to her, and she said, we need to watch this so we can get good at giving blowjobs because this video will teach us how to give blowjobs. And I remember I was 14 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thought of like when I see 14-year-olds now.
Yeah. You're just like, you don't need access to that.
I think like, oh my God, like what they have access to now compared to back then.
Yeah.
It's
and
just,
things they think they need to be good at.
Yeah, they think,
or have
and
practiced.
You know, it was just, it's a very interesting kind of social and like technological change.
Yeah. Well, I guess I always had like a really hard time because it was like, I was always very anxious about like intimacy. Mm-hmm. I was very like scared to like do something wrong. I was afraid to like, I didn't get my first kiss till I was like 16 or something like that. And like,
that's not that late.
That's not that late, but it also,
but at that time it feels late.
Yeah.
But it was also like, it was also under just like very strange circumstances of like her, you know, like finally making the first move. Mm-hmm. But it was like, I had all this stuff built up in my head of like watching media of like, you know, romantic comedies. This is how you're smooth.
Here's what I'm supposed to do.
And then there's this perfect moment where you know right when to kiss. And it's just like, that never happened.
You go
and then
10,
porn.
He goes, remember there was that one?
Yep.
About
like,
yeah, we have this loaded eye contact where it's like, No words.
We just
know
everything.
But we all need. But we need the words.
Yeah. And no one ever talks about how awkward shit can get too. And it's like that. I feel like people, once they experience awkwardness, they also experience shame. And it's like that like traversing through the awkwardness into like healthy communication and boundaries has always been a difficult time. And I feel like you kind of mentioned that like the gap between the medical side and like the performance side doesn't cover like how you should learn how to communicate your wants and your needs and how you should learn to expect.
Because it's not a game
and
it's not a show.
Yeah.
It's not a show. It's like an experience.
Yeah.
But we're taught, but because it's framed as a show and as a scene or like as something with a clear beginning, middle, and end.
Also, they're professionals.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
And it's cut. Like, I mean, it's all edited.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So again, it makes it difficult to feel like you're being like you're having successful, fulfilling like connections with people, I think. And it makes people feel like, you know, so ashamed, like you said, and like you're already failing before you've even begun.
Well, it sounds like all of us had like both sides of it, like where like we could see how it was harmful in some ways, like porn and some of the stuff we were exposed to. But then it sounds like all of us also had experiences where it was validating and helped us explore our sexuality. So I think it's kind of like it's a double-edged sword kind of, but I think it's better than not having it, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. And, you know, currently, like as you know, as far as like what's out there and available, the internet has made so many opportunities for like queer feminist porn makers and like you know giving people these connections that they could have never had without the internet and making the opportunity for people to actually like connect with others about these you know specific sexual interests and without the shame because they've made the community themselves
what I mean. I think there's like as much good as bad as it's probably done, I think, like, they can't
there's a lot of potential for the good.
Yeah, and they can't really be pulled apart, like, they come together, kind of.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think even just framing it that way is, like, there's, like, a fear of porn, but I feel like, you know, if you can acknowledge the parts that are educating, the parts that do build community, then, like, you know, it's not this big, scary thing, and it has a lot more potential to actually be, like, a positive.
Yeah, and if I may add one quick thing about because that's such a perfect, you know, indication of what porn studies aims to do, which is to find research and to do research about the facts of things rather than the fears of things. And so like a lot of research that showed that porn is bad for you was sponsored by groups that already felt that way.
Shocker.
And then they, you know, they sponsored research that would prove what they wanted to be right. And so that's how, misinformation, I mean, I don't even need to name names because we all know.
We know.
Can't imagine.
We know who they are. And that's the case in a lot, if not all, research. Mm-hmm. And it's why it's so important to know where research comes from
Who's
and to look at sources.
Mm-hmm. Who funded it.
Yeah. To look at really sources.
And how, like, the pool of people that they researched, like, how that was potentially cherry-picked.
Yeah, because headlines of research are often so misleading. They pick a point that they like from the study, and it's like, they said this, but then they also said how this doesn't mean anything.
Exactly.
You know,
but that's not the headline.
Read the conclusions,
It's about statistical literacy is one part of it, because a lot of research these days is big data. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, you know, we've got all these massive data sets about people who watch porn. You know, for example, Pornhub, MindGeek is, I think, their bigger corporation. They have the most data on, they have data on all of us. Mm-hmm. If you've been on Pornhub, which we all have, I mean.
My mom watches this. No.
I don't know what you're talking about. What is that? Please tell me what that is.
It's not by accident.
We need to wrap up, but my friend's in Texas right now, and they just changed the law, and he can't get into Pornhub. I tried to send him something, and he was like, I can't fucking look at it. He's like, what the fuck? And then he found an article about it. Yeah, they just like banned access to Pornhub or something in Texas.
Womp, womp.
Anyway,
womp, womp. Yeah, that was a very sad note. Yeah. Sorry, Texas.
I don't think it'll be permanent,
You know, there's VPNs. You can get a VPN.
All right, well, we're going to take a real quick commercial break, and we'll be right back.
It's not a commercial.
It's not a commercial break.
Just a regular break.
We're going to take a regular-ass break with the smoke break. And welcome back to the Smoke Break. I'm your host, your old pal Zane, here with Zoe Schwartz.
Hello.
Taylor Barrett.
Hello.
And Olivia Zivit.
Hi.
During this section, we actually want to talk about intersectional feminism.
Nailed it.
I said racism last time, not important. Zoe, go ahead and tell us a little bit about it.
Okay, well, like, my understanding of intersectional feminism is, like, it acknowledges all the different people's identities and how all these different systems of oppression intersect. And so I think it's a really interesting way to talk about our relationship to our sexuality and our sexual identity. And I think it's probably part of like an essential understanding or awareness in order to have like a healthy balance of trying to take in all this media that we're talking about and how to you know, consolidate it into like a healthy relationship with your own sexuality.
Yeah. And intersectional feminism really is about like true equality and not alienating people who aren't women or queer. Mm-hmm. And so when I say, you know, feminism, usually they think we think about, you know, women who could be TERFs, like a trans exclusionary radical feminist. That's kind of, you know, part of the...
It's still excluding a group.
It's excluding a group, right? And intersectional feminism really wants to, you know, incorporate everyone's voice, which includes men who I think in a lot of ways feel alienated by, you know, queer discourse because they are
straight men.
Straight, right. I'm sorry. Yeah. Cis straight men feel like further and further from the zeitgeist, like the discourse, and, you know, end up becoming this group that's othered and therefore has no opportunity to actually be allies.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they become like quite the opposite because they feel othered.
Exactly.
They feel so alone in it that they just, you know, feed into other people who feel alone in it instead of it bringing everybody.
The assumption that like feminism excludes cis straight men like has a tendency to alienate them and they begin to view it as like opposing them.
Feminism is anti-me. No, it's like anti-oppression. It's not
feminism includes cis straight white men.
And it should
despite
be.
That, like despite them not knowing that all the time.
But there's still a loss of power involved in that resistance.
Absolutely.
Right? So I think that's also important to mention is like men do have more power in this conversation.
But I think that when it's a threat and when it feels when, you know, people are alienated in any way, they are radicalized.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were talking earlier a little bit about like this kind of culture of individualism and, you know, everyone's an individual. It's like we need each other and we need to talk about, you know, how to build a stronger community for real, not just how to, you know, validate our own, you know, niche little part of the world. Like, you know, really empowering men to see that like there are ways to be an ally in a way, and you know their view and their experience of marginalization is just as valid. And I obviously don't want to get canceled. There are people who are radical on, you know, one end who would say just saying that is apologizing for like, you know, the patriarchal institution, but it's just not true because we're all like we need each other on a community level, and we're not all part of. I mean, we're all part of these big systems, but we as individuals need to be able to reach out to each other.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's just, it's also the acknowledgement that like, and I think somebody had said this earlier when we were talking about it, was just that like the patriarchy also affects men in a negative way.
Yes.
Like, that's
the Barbie movie was
the Barbie movie. Yeah.
But people missed that point, I think.
So many people. So many people.
It's like a very smart kind of subtle message in there, but it's the message that like the patriarchy is bad for all of us.
Yeah. And well, I mean, I've definitely felt like there were parts of like I've had a weird relationship to men just because like I never really felt like I fit in with them. Mm-hmm. You know, like I didn't talk the way they did. I didn't walk the way they did. So like I felt very alienated mm-hmm. by them. And then when I would like participate in the things that I thought men did, which were like, hey, you know, let's talk about how they have a face or whatever. You
blended in really well.
Yeah, I was like, they don't know I'm queer or possibly non-binary. They have no idea. I'll figure it out later. But I think it was just like I felt alienated by that as well. But mm-hmm. there were times where like before I understood what feminism was, like I thought that like, you know, men hate me because I'm not a real man. Women hate me because I'm a man by their definition. So it's like where do I go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel like men are, I mean, we as a society are going through a huge social change, a revolution right now. I mean, it's the queer revolution. And the future of humanity is in non-reproductive pairings. Well, like, we need less people, not more. So, you know, people are queerer than ever. And, like, that's a threat to, like, the basic role that men feel like they can be very responsible for, which is...
Or that they're almost entitled to.
They're entitled to, which is, like, reproducing. And it's, like, when that's less important than ever, it it's like a species threat. I don't know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That makes me think about it. Like, I don't know a ton of like I'm definitely not super informed, but like the idea of like queer politics being like really the most inclusional politic because it does acknowledge the intersectionality of all layers of oppression. Mm-hmm. And so like queerness is kind of a solution to like our understanding things with queer lens.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Is kind of like the solution to a lot of like, well, not the solution, but you know what I mean? Like it's the perspective that we need to have in order to understand how all these things really are interconnected.
I think that's because it doesn't exclude cishet people at all.
And a lot of cishet policies exclude queer people.
It's fucked up.
Well, and also just because it acknowledges all of these layers because like a trans black woman is like at the greatest level of oppression, like because of
just
all
like
of,
literal risk,
like literally yeah, like, because yeah. of the layers of oppression, yeah, because of these systems of
violence
oppression.
And like yeah. well-being type it. Risk, yeah. Versus, yeah. But there's different types of like risk, and you know, random acts of senseless violence are only increasing these days.
Yeah,
and it's because people need to belong, and when we don't give people the opportunity to feel like they're actually part of their community, I think we're just going to keep suffering. And as individuals, all we can do is just like be good people to the individuals we meet IRL. Yeah.
I like that idea too. I think because I think sometimes I feel, or I'm sure other people feel, like they're not being political enough, like outwardly. Mm. Like I don't use my social media really to talk about
me neither.
Stuff. And I think sometimes people think like, oh, is she this or that or whatever? And I'm
if
like,
you're not saying anything. No, I'm going to decide the story.
But yeah, I'll get
like
into
we notice when you don't post things. It's like that is such an alienating statement.
For sure. But in my personal life, I think we forget the power of like you said, like small acts or just conversations or like disrupting certain conversations, like
showing up and being there for actual you know, we
being a community member, supporting people that are struggling, having conversations with people that don't get it, you know. So I think like I try to remind myself that is I'm a super political person in my personal life, but I don't put a lot of it on the social media because it just feels more effective to me, and it feels like an intimate thing to put social media for comedy a lot of the time.
Yeah, in comedy we're walking this fine line between like, you know, having that public image and living for spreading our jokes. That's all we want to do is just make people laugh.
Yeah. Well, something that you had said was like talking to people, you know, like that don't understand, you know, like because it's like I felt like in my experience, it was like I didn't have any idea of what, like, even though I was raised by two women, I had no idea what feminism was. Mm-hmm. Very strange to say. But I mean, I feel like they were also kind of like at you know, they were also suffering from the patriarchy.
We talked about this in one of our episodes.
So they were also suffering similarly. And then I dated somebody who was like a feminist and they gave me like this newer idea of like, you know, something that she had always said was, you know, I don't hate men. I hate what men are taught to be.
Yeah.
And I, for me, that like that made so much more sense because it's just like, yes, the things that we're taught to be, the things that we perpetuate are the things that like I hate. Like, I don't necessarily hate men, but like I hate the things that like I am assumed to have to be to be one.
A culture of masculinity is harmful to everybody too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think I used to have this joke. I never really perfected it, but it was something along the lines of like, you know, pressure affects all of us, right? Mm-hmm. But women are under pressure to be small, which makes sense because that's what the forces of pressure do. It makes you itty bitty. I'm just a little baby, kind of. I'm just a little lady. But men are under pressure to be big. And that's a work, that's an antagonistic kind of force. And I think that it's so difficult for boys to, you know, to find their community now because of this big change we're going through as far as what is true masculinity. Well, we're learning that gender is a social construct and that gender roles are fluid and that gender roles aren't a binary anymore.
Yeah.
And the pressure to be big makes it really difficult to like find an identity too, because like my personal experience with that was like when I came out as bisexual and it was like late middle school, it was really alienating. I feel like I was a lot more accepted by women and girls, and the distance that other men put in between us was like it came from like a standpoint of fear or like disgust or like confusion or like whatever. But like that pressure to feel that made it really difficult for me to even make that step. And I'm really glad that I did, and I found a lot more comfortability, and I would call myself pansexual now. But
I'm pan too.
Hell yeah, I represent.
Was that a pan fist bump? That was really cool.
Pan pump.
Pan pump.
Oh, we should make that a thing. Pan.
I feel like everybody's probably pan if we weren't influenced by it.
I think so. I really think so.
Yeah.
I think I'm just still oppressed a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful thing to have a sexuality that's not necessarily like everything about you. Like when you're straight, people don't think that like you're always fucking. But the moment that you're pan, it's like, oh, you must be a skank.
It's like you'd be hoeing. And it's just the idea that like you're pan for the sexual experience.
Yeah.
You know, instead of just being like, I connect with everybody. Well, like that's
the weirdest thing also is that being pan implies that like you're open to every type of expression, but it doesn't mean that you have a sexual checklist that you have checked all those boxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just means you're not totally closed off to it.
It just means that you're open to it, but like, you know,
and the genitalia isn't like the defining factor of whether or not I'm attracted
to
somebody.
Right.
And I think that that's, you know, we don't assume that straight people aren't straight if they're virgins. And you know, people who are gay, like they are, you know, 100% gay, which is 100% homo, which is honestly, first of all, jealous. I wish. But yeah, I do like men a lot. So, but
I'm
sorry. We have new opportunities to be in the middle now, and like never before.
Yeah.
It's so fun.
And I think like because there are the opportunities to like be in the middle, like it creates less pressure to be something that you don't necessarily identify with.
Yes, you know? And the freedom to just kind of like, it depends.
Yeah. And that's good for like becoming a fully self-actualized human, right? Like that's how we become a full person, is like having access to not feeling shame about like all the parts of ourselves.
Right.
Being safe to explore all the parts of ourselves without shame.
Yeah. And it requires a good amount of communication like with yourself and honesty with yourself.
Self-reflectivity, reflexive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. All right. Well, excellent. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with the smoke break.
Not a commercial.
And welcome back to the Smoke Break. I'm your host, Joel Palzane, here with Zoe Schwartz.
Hi, T.
Taylor Barron.
What's up?
And Olivia Zibbett.
Howdy do.
Zibbett.
Wrestler intro. Coming to the arena.
She's like a wrestler, yeah. Like, I'll wrestle if you want to wrestle.
Canadian Jewish princess.
Okay.
So on this section, we wanted to talk about humanization and dehumanization. Mm-hmm. We actually had a meeting this week where our boss and a lot of our other bosses were just like, y'all need to humanize each other because I feel like you're being mean and it's because you don't see each other as people. And
I would say people and human is maybe a semantic difference too. Right?
Really? Yeah, how so?
Well, I mean, you could talk about like a human being versus like a person, and that's where like dehumanizing comes in.
Mm.
So it's like you can intellectually acknowledge, yeah, we're all human beings, but personhood is kind of what they use in like the reproductive rights debate.
Okay.
I did not understand the difference, but I now do.
I was just like,
I'm glad you walked us there.
I think that like I could be wrong here, but I think a person has rights and like a, Jesus. You know.
Well, yeah, because that's that whole conversation about like
but
an embryo
human
being
doesn't
a
have rights. That's
whoa.
Is this news to you?
Yeah. I'm surprised as a black man in America. I'm like, what?
That's just like semantic differences, but it's part of the topic, which is like,
well, I mean, I think that, you know, like semantic differences is you know, like a good place to even like
language
point
is powerful.
Out.
It makes a huge difference.
Powerful.
Yes.
Is that it's, you know, like if we see somebody as a person, you know, it's like that determines whether or not like our interaction with them.
Mm-hmm.
So like, what do you think sort of like leads to like dehumanization?
I would say that late stage capitalism does a lot of, you know,
gotta be better than someone.
I would say that, you know, I would, not to be an annoying asshole, but Karl Marx.
Oh, this guy?
Ever heard of him?
Good old Marx
names. That sounds dope.
Get a haircut. Karl Marx has this concept of alienation.
Okay.
Which was basically observing how when people are alienated from the products of their labor.
Oh, I know all about this.
We lose touch with,
we're meant to make stuff, but we're meant to be connected to
We're meant to be connected to each other. And what alienation does, and like late stage capitalism, a global economy, it makes the way we spend money and what money means part of our identity and part of what gives us rights, kind of. Like, isn't it crazy? You know, in America, gosh, you can be, if you have money, the rules don't really apply to you.
The justice system is totally,
And what that does is make people lose faith in democracy. They're in, you know, this, the powers that be. And
understandably,
this is all a big cycle of, like, you know, globalization, which is the ultimate challenge because we have different cultures. And there's, I don't know if there's such thing as a global culture. We have global capitalism and a global economy. But I think
there's
I don't know,
something that's connecting.
I'm a cultural relativist. So I actually believe that, like, as far like moral relativity as well, I radically accept that people in different cultures have different ways of thinking of what is right and wrong.
We just even like the animals that we eat, you can see that.
100%.
Right?
Yeah. 100%. Good point. Good point. You can't control how ancient intrinsic parts of our culture. You can't, like, Westerns, people from the West, people in the West, capital W, have this idea that we are, like, a global force for morals.
Yeah, yeah. We know what good is. We'll tell you.
Yeah, because we're so
historically
good.
We killed everybody,
good.
So that's how we know.
So you can either be rich and have human rights or be a capitalist success and not. So I would say places like China, Bangladesh, India, where they're are no protections for workers, and so people can be exploited. And then that way we don't have to exploit workers in America, and we can buy things really cheap.
And we can pretend that we're better than everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
And we can forget about it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I think it even, like, you know, it comes from that separation of just, like, you know, I wouldn't put an American worst person through that, you know.
Exactly.
But
that's where your shit comes from.
But they've been dehumanized to but like you know, like you said, you know, when we're dehumanizing other people, it's okay to treat them poorly.
Well, I can pay them less because they're not, you know, they're not our people.
And I wouldn't say that we're okay with that on a day-to-day level.
No,
are, like, we are complicit in it without even understanding.
If you don't think about it and talk about it, it can be a big bummer.
Well, and even, and also the
even
idea.
Even if you talk about it, it can still be a
bummer. It is a bummer when you talk about it.
Well, yeah, okay, I would say it's a bummer.
But it's worth being surprised by it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Well, and that's another conversation for people that don't even have, like, the access to the education to understand the oppression that they're experiencing. Like, that's a whole nother level.
Well, I mean, that's something
disempowerment is like, you don't even have the right information to understand what's happening to you. You know what I mean?
And we're just individuals, right? Yeah. Like, how, like, the concept that we can change these massive systems is, it's false. So we can just, as individuals, try and be better. So one thing I like to do to, you know, help with clothing waste is I buy most my clothes secondhand.
Okay.
And it's not much, obviously, but
it's a contribution.
But it's a tiny way that I can feel like, okay, I'm not buying fast fashion and I'm not, like, supporting that kind of, you know,
exploitation
and super high environmental waste as well.
True.
Because the earth is, you know, I do care about the earth.
It's pretty sweet. I
and
like
people.
It. It's where I keep my stuff.
I hang out here.
I got a storage unit on the moon.
My family lives here. But I think also talking to, like, when it comes to dehumanization or the idea of humanization, I think, like we kind of talked about with intersectionality, like the idea of, I totally just lost my train of thought.
Was it about clothes?
Humanization.
The idea of, like, I totally forgot it. Okay, somebody else say what they were going to say. I had a thought in it.
Nope, it's fine.
You said something really, we were talking earlier about how,
I remember.
Go.
I was thinking about hierarchical beliefs, like the idea of how we categorize people as more valuable. So I don't know why my brain just farted.
You're
hardcore.
Fine.
But how we categorize people as less valuable and more valuable, and the markers of, like, and I think it's
what gives a person value? What gives them enough value that, like, I will treat them with, you know? Well, it's like, even like the idea that, like, you know, you have to respect your elders. It's like, they have to have this, they're your elder, therefore they've reached this mark, so now they can be treated like this.
Yeah, they, you know, they have a sense of, like, immunity because of their time spent, and their merit isn't even questionable now because of the time that they've been alive.
And they're more of a person than, like, a younger kid because they've had less time. So it's like, you know, this person is more valued.
If anything, I think it should be kind of swapped almost, where it's like younger,
ageism. Yeah.
Like, the kids should have a sense of immunity because they're children and literally don't know. And the adults should be held to a much higher standard because they've had time for their prefrontal lobe to develop and give them a sense of morality and ethics.
But we should also value age too, in the sense we don't value age in our culture.
People live way too long. long, first of all.
I
would just say, like,
I've made it 30 years. I'm done.
Our teeth don't last.
Like we mentioned before, the radicalness of the change of the world it's almost incomprehensible to older people who haven't had somebody to lovingly explain to them what the fuck is going on.
Mm-hmm. Lovingly explain. That's a good way of putting it.
Because, like, again, we're social creatures, but we're creatures of habit. Mm-hmm. And we also can't learn what we don't know.
Yeah.
And so, like, people who are, who are younger and very upset with the older generations, it's like, it comes down to these individual relationships, family and friends. Yeah. And somebody, you can't expect the media to teach you anything.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, like, just reaching across the table for, like, that connection, like, just understanding that, like, we as individuals kind of have to educate each other, because if we leave it up to fucking media, like, we might get lucky and get a Barbie movie, but for the most part, we're all just kind of like, each of us is learning without, like, you know, connecting with each other.
And it's also okay to, not take that responsibility too.
I think so. I don't want to put it on the individuals, but at the same time, I want to acknowledge that individuals have an impact.
I mean, I think this kind of circles back to how important, like, community is, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not one person's job to be the educator of the elderly. Yeah. But, like, that is one thing that I feel like my grandma has been very receptive of. I think she struggles with plenty of stuff as far as like the gap between her and my generation, and then also the younger generation. But she's been very receptive to, like, learning how to do things. Mm-hmm. Like she didn't text or use the internet, and now smartphones exist. And that melding of two things that she's not used to was, like, impossible for her to navigate. And so she's been receptive of me trying to show her stuff, how to, like, set up her phone.
Because that connects you guys and strengthens your relationship.
Absolutely it does, yeah.
And, I mean, I think that especially, like, with technology and as a millennial, even I sometimes feel like, what the hell with technology? And like, to imagine, like, also being, you know, having aged and, like, lived through so much of human communication not being like that.
Yeah.
And then it's alienating, like we talked about. And it's othering and it sucks.
Yeah. So I was thinking about, like, dehumanization from the perspective of, like, because you guys work with the houseless community, and I have worked in the houseless community. Yeah. And I think for me, it was a really big wake up call to, like, understand how powerful dehumanization can be.
Oh, absolutely.
And working, like, in that. Yeah, I just think it was a really important lesson.
Like, something that I tried to, you know, when we were, like, talking about it and stuff like that, we're like, you know, how can we be more humanizing for our coworkers? How can we be more humanizing for the clients? And something I'd said is, I was just like, acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's such a simple thing to just be like, hey, what's up? Like, you're a person.
I
you know what I mean?
I was just about to say the littlest interactions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because so many people, like, if everybody's walking past you and won't make eye contact, assumes that you want something, that's super fucking dehumanizing.
Yeah. And then sometimes somebody will interact with you and be an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, and you get a job. Right. And it's like, bro, come on.
Yeah. So it's like, you're either not being interacted with or having negative experiences. So it's like, you, the humanizing thing that you can do is just, you know, hey, what's up? You know, like,
how's it going?
Yeah. How's it going?
I love that you ask clients a lot what they're excited for.
Even
if they say nothing, then that gives an opportunity for you to, like, have that conversation. And like, that, I think that
it
what
makes
you
them
excited
feel
for
like their world is important, because I feel like that's what dehumanization is like, making you feel like you're not important, your world isn't important, your concerns aren't important.
Yeah,
like,
your perspective isn't acknowledged. Yeah.
Exactly.
Your experiences aren't valid.
Yeah. Yeah, or they're your fault. That's another big one. It's like, all of the oppression that you're experiencing is because you're not good enough at being a human or whatever.
And it's so hard to climb out of such a horrible circumstance if you don't even have internal self-worth.
Yeah, which if you didn't have a supportive environment growing up, you're probably going to struggle with that, because I struggle with it and I supposedly did.
Right, we need each other. And
you struggle with that anyway as humans.
Yeah,
you know?
The small interactions really matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, like, what do you think goes a long ways towards humanizing people?
I think slowing down and, like, enjoying the little interactions. I feel like whenever I'm out shopping, I love, like, talking with kids, or like, just a little smile and a wave at a kid, especially if they're a toddler, like, they'll wave back. And then there might be with a single parent, or, you know, some people who have kids in tow, they're always like, and when they're shopping, they're always, like, annoyed because, like, this kid is slowing me down. But, like, it's just one of my personal practices is to, like, give a parent, like, or a caretaker or whoever with a kid, just give a little positive interaction, like a smile, and you're helping with the shopping. That's really good. And those little things, because child rearing is very isolating.
Sure.
And that's one thing that our community doesn't really do like we did for throughout human history, which is like live in tightly knit communities and help each other.
I was gonna say same with aging people too.
Yeah,
now we put them in homes.
Yeah, I didn't even think
about
that.
And we just sequester people, and like in more traditional cultures, you know, the elderly will live with their two or three generations below them, and you know, be involved, not like written off. At, oh, if you're no longer like a productive capitalist, like you should just go live in a dorm and get chlamydia. Yeah, retirement.
Doesn't everybody do that?
Retirement communities are like single-handedly keeping chlamydia and gonorrhea alive in the world. So
respect,
thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, I like it that old people are fucking.
I mean, yeah. I just want them to use a condom.
Yeah,
or a dental dam. Yeah. I mean, or if you don't have teeth, I guess you don't.
Or just dentures.
Take the dentures out and you're good. Just gum it.
I was going to say, if you had
give
a gum
that
job,
gummy toppy. Oh my God. Get it, Grandma.
Oh my God.
What did you say?
Gummy toppy?
Jesus.
Yummy.
Gummy.
Gummy. Oh, I was like, what?
No teeth.
Maybe it's yummy. I don't fucking, you know.
Okie doke. Like, well, this has been the smoke break.
Yeah.
Are you doing the face?
Yeah. Still.
Watch the video. This has been an amazing episode. Olivia, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been such a privilege and pleasure talking to you guys.
Yeah, thank you for being here. It was
I feel
awesome.
Like we could have talked for like an hour more.
It's it's just such a pleasure to like get invited to something like this. I have so much respect for you guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us.
We respect you.
All right. Well, that has been The Smoke Break. We will see you next time.
Cowabunga.
Gummy toppy.
Hang loose, brother.
Sounds like a cake topping.
It sounds like a lewd sex act.